This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Ian Clifford is the president of Lighthouses of Australia joining us. Hello, Ian.
Good morning, Trevor.
Hey, Ian, let's start out before there were lighthouses. Was there any other navigational aid or warning for people off the coastlines before lighthouses?
Oh, various things were tried. Lumps of coal burning on hilltops. Daytime, they'd obviously fly flags and things like that. But lighthouses have been with us for a very long time, since ancient times, actually, that they've been used in one form or another.
So the ability to build them was there, and I would presume as soon as we had a settlement in Australia, there was a recognition for the need of them.
Quite shortly after, so Macquarie was the first light built in Australia, although the tower that stands there now near Vaucluse is a replacement tower that was built in 1883. But the first light there was the first in Australia built, was built in 1817 by an ex-convict architect, Francis Greenaway.
So, because I guess there are two reasons for lighthouses. One is to navigate ships into port, and so they know where to come in at night. And the other one is to give warnings of dangerous bits of coastline. Is it a mixture of both where they were first introduced?
It is. So in Australia, which of course is what we're talking about, New South Wales, for instance, you've got lights placed on the coast. And those lights were described by one of the designers as a highway of lights. So there are lights placed to mark port entries, and good examples of those are Wollongong Harbour is a small light to mark an entry, Richmond River at Balna, Tacking Point. There's a few of them up and down the coast. But then you have your large lights, which everybody would know. Cape Byron is one. Point Perpendicular is another, Green Cape's another, Montague Island. Those lights were generally placed for navigation to mark a path up the coast.
And was that, because I always wondered with the positioning of lighthouses, was that because it's recognised that that is where there's the likelihood of a wreck? Or did they take a look at where there have been wrecks and decide this is where they need one?
Well, they positioned them at prominent points, so as waypoints for navigation, because they needed a point for ships to navigate. In some instances, they were close to places where there'd been many, many examples of misnavigation resulting in wrecks. So the answer to that's a little bit of both. Obviously, along the south coast of Australia, lights were placed and there had been many, many wrecks. Cape Otway is one of the landfall lights in Australia, still is actually. That's now has a solar tower replacing the heritage tower. So in Australia, we've got something like 130 or so heritage towers that still stand that were built quite early on. As I say, from 1817 on, and you've got lots of modern lights. We're still rolling out some modern solar lights, which are often built on a lattice tower with a fiberglass cubicle to hold the batteries, and they have a solar light in the top. They're still rolling those out over the last few years. We've got 360 or 70 lights in Australia.
And, does that mean that they're still necessary, even with the navigational abilities that ships have now, that there's still a need for a light?
Well, lights are paid for by the collection of shipping dues. And shipping companies to this day are more than happy to keep paying shipping dues to maintain lights. So the answer to the question is that, it's still being funded. I know that as an occasional seafarer, it's very reassuring to see a light. It's validation of your electronic instruments. And I know that having spoken to some of the pilots, I live in Kiama, which is on the south coast, talking to some of the Port Kembla pilots, they regularly still use the Wollongong Head Lighthouse, which is a AMSA, maintain lighthouse. Australian Maritime Safety Authority maintain the big lights in Australia. The smaller lights are maintained by the state, so they're funded by boat licence, ultimately. So your Balna, Tacking Point at Port Macquarie, Point Ferry in Victoria, those smaller lights are maintained by the state, and that's done through boating licences. So people are still using them.
Yeah, I guess it just makes you feel good, or the knowledge that they're there, even though there may be navigational instruments that can do the job. It's good to have that backup and to be able to see.
I guess it's a uniquely human thing. We like to have a visual orientation, if you like. So the light gives mariners that visual orientation on top of what they can see on their instruments.
I love the idea of tradition too, or just that those things stay. Joseph joins us. Hello, Joseph.
Oh, yeah, Trevor. Joseph Carter, this in Townsville. I'm the historian for my lighthouse family. I have four lighthouse keepers.
Joseph, so people have been operating lighthouses in your family for how long?
Late in 1900.
Yes, the Carter family is very well known. They were very prominent at the Queensland Lights and served for many, many years across Queensland at various stations.
Why was it so significant that families were involved in the lighthouses?
Well, the interview process involved the wives, so it was a team effort. I guess a little bit like modern day, it took a team to run a lighthouse. So most lighthouses had two or three keepers. The larger lights had three keepers and associated families. And there's a great set of books out on Busted Head, written by Stuart Buchanan. If people want to read a little bit about the good and the bad of family history in lights, so obviously lives were lost, and in those days they were very remote. And it took wives to raise the family. There was a saying that used to go around about the work that was done, and the wives were integral in the operation of the stations. And, of course, being remote, children had to be educated remotely. Some keepers chose to put their children ashore or in major centres for education, but there were plenty that educated on the station with correspondence education, and the wives ran that generally. They were the educators. And there are some stations, and Busted Head is one, where a school teacher was appointed. If you had three families in those days, it's quite possible you could have up to 30 or more children on a station.
When you take a look at that, because where people lived could be so varying, because if you're on the coast, then you had a relative amount of space, but some people were on islands and very small islands as well.
That's so true, and South Solitary Island is a great example, as is South Neptune Island off the south coast of SA. Deal Island's another one, Mitsaika Island. We've got lots of island-located lighthouses and associated infrastructure to house the families. And, yes, it was not an option to go to school every day. It might have been if you were placed at Cape Schenck or, Cape Byron or one of those stations, but the vast majority were way too far from schools.
Brett, good morning.
Morning, Trevor. I don't know your guest name.
His name's Ian.
Ian, I just wanted to ask, during the war, did the lighthouses still operate or were they turned off for darkness reasons?
Well, great question.
That is a great question. Good morning, Brett. Some lights did operate, but quite a few were turned off. I don't know which were actually turned off, but yes, there were quite a few that were turned off so as not to give any assistance to invaders.
But then how did local shipping, I guess local shipping would have been affected anyway because of the war.
It was, and with difficulty. As you know, there were many, many torpedoed vessels sunk off the coast here. And in fact, up at Point Danger at Tweed Heads, there is a walk that has a plaque for each vessel that was sunk in the Second World War.
How did they, we talked a little bit about the function and how they work. How did the design of the lighthouses themselves change over a period of time?
Well, the probably the biggest single element of design, and one that in some ways attracted me to lights, was the development of the Fresnel lens in the 1840s by a Frenchman. And that revolutionised capturing light and focusing light into a beam. So prior to that, lights were lit with a series of reflectors and oil lamps in front of those reflectors, which are quite inefficient in capturing light. The Fresnel lens was able to have a single light source in the early days, an oil-burning wick arrangement that was placed in the middle of the large Fresnel lens, and up to 90% of that light was captured and focused into a beam. That was one of the biggest single developments. There were others along the way, such as vaporised kerosene. And for the invention of the acetylene-operated light by a Swede, Dalen, he received the Nobel Prize for his development of lighthouse technology. And acetylene burners were a massive revolution in lights. As some people may think negatively, because it allowed the demanding of previously manned lights, because the lights could be automated. You could place a series of cylinders in the bottom, and the burner, coupled up with his development of a sun valve, meant that during the day a very, very small, you can barely see it, pilot light was lit, and that was lit all the time. And then when the sun fell and the sun valve opened up the gas or the major gas supply, that ignited the major burner. And he developed ways of flashing that, which also gave each light a different character using a flash burner. So that let automation happen, and it also let thousands upon thousands of light-mounted buoys to be placed. So the Dalen invention was incredibly important. So was the Fresnel lens. And the other big development was the development of the kerosene mantle, or the vaporised kerosene burner. And they replaced quite quickly in Australia the oil-burning lamps that were fitted in the big lenses, and that massively increased the light output. So the other thing that we would be remiss to not mention is that the Commonwealth took over many of the state lights after Federation, and particularly after a report was generated by Brewis. Brewis was tasked by the Commonwealth to go around and look at every light around the Australian coast, audit the lights, and come back with a report for further improvement and, you know, in some cases automation, all sorts of modernisation. And the Brewis report saw some of the older lights were sped up. Lots of lights got kerosene mantle burners to, or vaporised burners to increase the intensity. And that was largely generated by the transition from sails, so sailing ships, to steam-powered ships, because we'd all realise how much faster steam-powered ships travel. And in the old days, it might have taken a light 3 minutes to do one rotation, if it was a rotating big light. Brewis, in many cases, sped those up to something in the order of, in some cases, as quick as 30 seconds, because vessels needed much more accurate fixing and more regularly because of the speed they were travelling.
We'll come back to automation in a second. Prue, hello.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for this. I've had some confusion. But firstly, what the beacons, do they have lights that are along the coast? Like there's the beacon at 13th Beach. Does that have a light on it? Or is it just that wooden beacon thing, that triangle shape?
Oh, okay. And what did you want to mention with Queenscliff?
Well, I also wanted to find, I've got confused with the black lighthouse and the two other, like there's the white lighthouse at Queen's Living on. There's also the lighthouse at Point Lonsdale. But the black lighthouse, it was built black because they didn't want it to be bombed in case of the First World War. Is that right?
Yeah.
No, the two lights you're referring to there are front and rear lights for the ships entering Port Phillip Bay. So they use those to line up when they're entering Port Phillip Bay. Point Lonsdale, it marks the entrance to the bay, and then the lights behind are used to physically line up the channel.
Because I've got a text here that says, why isn't there a lighthouse in Point Nepean in Victoria? Is that because they're on the other side, so the ones in Queenscliff do for both sides?
Well, the lights at Queenscliff that we've mentioned here, when you come into a port, you often use lights to mark the channel, and when you are lined up in the channel, the two lights will line up. One's usually higher than the other, so the rear is built to be higher than the other.
Oh, yeah.
So that the pilot or the vessel master can actually physically line those lights up, and that can be lined up day or night. Now, obviously, there are other ways to mark channels, and they use triangles. The rear is usually a triangle with the Sharpie point down. And you line those up. Sometimes they're physical boards painted orange or a bright colour. They're all different ways to mark beacons. And by the way, sometimes in some ports, those boards are lit, but they're not lighthouses.
Gordon, hello.
Hello.
Yes, Gordon.
Yeah, I lived on Matsoka Island, mate.
Oh, okay, and tell us about Matsoka Island.
It's windy, 40-mile-an-hour wind nearly all day. You've got a haulage system to get stuff up from your jetty onto the back of a Jeep and trailer and around to the lighthouse.
Is that one of the difficult things about the job, was actually just physically getting stuff to and from on the island?
Yes, one of them.
And what were the others?
Well, just being there with the wind.
Yeah.
Very windy place, Gordon. Matsoka, isn't it?
Yeah. The difficulty of getting stuff there, our lighthouse boats come down. You've probably heard of the SS Cape York. It come down to drop off our supplies.
Yep.
And they got the kerosene off and the petrol off for the Jeep and the haulage system. Then the wind came up that bad, they couldn't load into the work boats. So they turned around and said, we'll go back to Hobart. And when that dies down, we'll come back. We never seen another boat for 3 months.
Gordon, what year were you at Matsoka, roughly?
Back in the 40s.
Yeah, because the Cape York was the first generation of the larger lightships with the Cape Otway.
Yeah.
And then later on, of course, we had the Cape Don, Cape Pillar and Cape Morton. Cape Pillar being the vessel that served the Tasmanian lights.
Yeah, I lived on Low Head Lighthouse. You heard of that one?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, Low Head, beautiful light and a very prominent light, yes. Tamar River. Mm.
Yeah, we lived in three of the biggest houses on the lighthouses, four-bedroom houses.
Gordon, thank you.
That's great.
Mm. It's interesting when you listen to that. Were there people that worked and rotated around the lighthouses, Ian, or did you work on one for a period of time and then that was it?
No, the keepers were rotated, and as Gordon mentioned, he was obviously rotated through what would have been the Tasmanian lights. So quite often they'd give you a posting at a light like Matsoka, which is extremely remote, very difficult to access service by ship at that time. Then you might receive a posting at the likes of Low Head, as he mentioned, which is, you know, you could send your children to school there. It's near the major centre of Launceston, not too far away. You may have also been posted at Eddystone Point, which should be a lot better than Matsoka in the sense that at least you're on the Tasmanian, I'll call it the mainland, rather than on an island off Tasmania. So the keepers in all states were rotated through the state lights. And later on in the Commonwealth Lighthouse Service, which is what was created after the Brewis Report, in 1915, if you were an employee of that service, you were still generally placed within a state and moved around within that state.
Was it, is it true that after the war that a lot of naval servicemen became lighthouse keepers? It was a position that they went into?
Yeah, they were often given preference. They were already trained in quite a few of the skills, such as signalling, and obviously, you know, very familiar with vessels and shipping, so keeping logs was something they were used to. So, yes, there was a lot of ex-servicemen that were lighthouse keepers. Not all, but quite a few were, particularly in the earlier days, were ex-mariners.
Patsy, hello.
Good morning. Yes, I'd like to hear something about the South Head and the North Head in Sydney. I've forgotten a lot of things, but the first ship that went down within the harbour, and they were waiting for that one to actually, that was when the convicts first came, and I think it was before the Freeman, and they were waiting for that ship to come in. It was fully loaded. But it went down right within sight of the people standing on the beach within the harbour.
Ian?
Yes, there were, as you would realise, the entrance to Sydney Harbour's quite, if you were at sea, it's not an easy entrance to pick. And the first light that was built in 1817, which is the Macquarie Light, but that is up a little bit from the actual entrance to Sydney Harbour. The light that's down on Sydney Harbour is actually the Hornby Light, is right on the north, on the south head of Sydney Harbour. And that was built in the 1850s from memory. I think it was 1858, that light was built. That's still there today. And of course it's painted in red and white stripes to very clearly mark the harbour entrance during the day. And vessels do and did rely on that light as a visual day mark, as well as its flashing at night. And, of course, it had a different flash to the Macquarie Light, which is further up. So the Macquarie Light was a broad indication to the vessels that they're off Sydney, and the entrance was further marked much more precisely by the Hornby Light.
Thank you, Patsy. Good morning to you, Robert.
Oh, yeah, hi. Are there any of the large rotating lights still being used, and how many of the lighthouses are actually manned these days?
Well, the last lighthouse to be manned was Mitsaika Island in Australia. In fact, the Australia's last lighthouse keeper was Chris Richter, and he came off Mitsaika Island in August 1996. That was the time it was the original light was turned off and replaced by a Tupperware light. I think actually Chris may have left in early 97, but he was the last. Mitsaika, of course, was one of the big rotating lights you're talking about. Lights with a big first-order Fresnel lens still operating are the lights of Cape Lewin, Cape Byron, Smoky Cape, Sugarloaf Point, I'm trying to think. There's quite a few examples, but yeah. Cape Shank in Victoria, not forget that one. There are quite a few with smaller order Fresnel lenses. As people may or may not know, the Fresnel lenses, if they're Chance Brothers, which probably the majority are in Australia, although we have quite a few French lenses as well as quite a few Swedish AGA lenses. There are quite a few smaller Fresnel lenses that are still working in lights as well. And then, of course, there's quite a few that have been removed and replaced with what really is a plastic Fresnel lens. And that evolution is continuing. AMSA at the moment may have almost, if not completely, replaced incandescent globes with LEDs. And quite a few of those larger Fresnel lenses have an LED source in them now, which is remarkable considering the design was done in the 1840s and, you know, they've seen oil-burning wick light sources, vaporised kerosene, electric incandescent, and now they're seeing electric LED. It's quite remarkable.
With the introduction of the automated lighthouses, was there an aspect of tradition when there was the possibility of all of the lighthouses becoming automated, but there was a feeling that there needed to be manned lighthouses for traditional reasons?
Yes, there was a big pushback by a lot of people in the early 80s when automation was first mentioned in earnest by government. At that time, if I recall, it's going back a while, but I don't think we were doing, or the world economy wasn't too good there for a while, and Australia did have some recessions. And automation was a great way to reduce the operating costs of lights without giving too much of the efficiency away. And it was a thing that, well, you'd understand that people had been manning lights for well over 100 years.
Yeah.
And it certainly wasn't well received by many members of the public, particularly the boating public, and certainly wasn't well received by, you know, the light keepers. So there was a big pushback. And when Chris finished at Matsaika Island, that ended a whole tradition and lifestyle of light keeping, which, of course, now in the world, there's very few. There'd only be just a couple of lights that are manned. There's very few that are manned around the world. There are some countries that have watch stations associated with lighthouses, and they've kept people in the lights. But in Australia, of course, many stations have been handed to national parks, so we have caretakers. But in the sense of light keepers, well, Chris has he was the last keeper, so it was Chris Richter. But, yeah, that with him went that actual light-keeping lifestyle.
Kiri, hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. The west coast of Tasmania, I drove around it many years ago, and I don't recall any lighthouses there. Are there any there? And if there are, how come?
Oh, there is, and one of my favourite lights is around there, Cape Sorel. And that has a very interesting history because it was built at a time. It's a very prominent light, Cape Sorel. It's a large tower, a really beautiful wave-swept tower. Cape Sorel, what happened, the shipping that was navigating off the west coast of Tasmania and Macquarie Harbour at one time was seen as perhaps something that was going to be opened up as a major port. Cape Sorel was downgraded in the 1960s, and it was a fairly early automated light. We're so thankful that Cape Sorel kept its beautiful Chance Brothers lantern. It had a large second order Chance lens in it. But sadly that light was, the keepers were withdrawn, I think, around about 1971, the cottages were demolished that were associated with the keepers, and that was about the time it was demanned. So, yes, Cape Sorel, that's a big light around that side of Tasmania. Kiri, you have to go by boat to get to that one.
Kiri, thank you.
It is on the mainland, but there's no road to Cape Sorel.
Hello, Cara.
Hello, how are you going, Trev? Hello, Ian. How are you? It's lovely
Good
listening
morning.
To all of this. Good morning. I'm in the Hunter Valley in New South Wales at Cara. Look, I just simply wanted to say that in the very late 40s after the war, my uncle, Dan Highfield, was in the army and came back to Melbourne, married my auntie Shirley when she was only 15, and they went on to have 6 children in 6 years. He was a lighthouse keeper off Victoria. I'm sorry, I don't know where it was. I can't remember. And they've died now, of course. But Auntie Shirley had 6 children in 6 years, was featured on the front of the Women's Weekly because she was only 21 by the time they had the 6 kids, and she educated them all, and they lived on the light, and she did all the primary school education for them, and he kept the light. And then when the kids were high school age, they went to Victoria to stay with her sister to get their high school education. I think it's amazing what they did.
Do you remember him telling any stories or them telling stories about what it was like?
Pretty isolated.
Yeah.
But look, it was they had a lovely marriage for many, many, many years, and they stayed together the whole time.
Well, you think if you get through that sort of isolation, you'd do pretty well when you've finished working there as well.
I think so too. And then eventually they came back to Melbourne, and he became a caretaker at one of the big bank buildings in the city of Melbourne.
Kara, thank you. I'm going to go through a few calls. I'll come back to you in a second, Ian. Hello, Kim.
Good morning, Tara and Ian. I was wondering whether the lights themselves would be very heavy, and I think they were floating on the bath of mercury.
Is that right, Ian?
Yes, the large lenses, so the big, especially the first order, but second, third and fourth as well. Mercury floats were introduced, believe it or not, later than what a lot of people realise in Australia. Mercury floats were really rolled out in the 1920s. Prior to that, although I will point out that Cape Lewin, I think, was the first mercury float in Australia in 1899. But that mercury technology wasn't really introduced to around that time. Prior to that, they spun on roller bearing pedestals. And the only example I can think of off the top of my head in situ and alight in Australia of a roller bearing pedestal is at Mitsaika Island. That was there till the end, and it's still there today, and it can be operated.
Annette, hello.
Yes, hello. I visited King Island on two occasions and went to that mighty Cape Wickham lighthouse.
Cape Wickham, yes.
1861, and it had a range 24 nautical miles out and the height of 48 metres tall.
That's right, yes. Yeah, 48 metres to the top of the light, yes.
Yeah, and the elevation was 85 metres.
Yes. Yes, Cape Wickham is also, that's the tallest light tower in Australia.
I've got a text here. The Rotlesson Lighthouse is visible for long distances as well, including from the Perth Hills. Is that a traditional old rotating lighthouse?
Well, most of the lights were positioned and built to a height that gave a flash that was designed to hit your eyes on the bridge of a vessel at a certain distance off. So to give an example that most people would relate to is Cape Byron. And Cape Byron is designed for around about 26 nautical miles to sea. And that height of the tower is part of what dictates that. As everyone knows, there's a formula. You can work out what distance to the horizon from the height you're standing. Well, it's as simple as that, and the lights were designed to give that visibility. The advantage of the big lights that we're talking about is that they also produce a lume because they're so bright, so that's hitting the particles of dirt and dust and whatever in the atmosphere. Hmm. On a good clear night, one of those big first-order lenses, especially with electric illumination, they could be seen at 40 kilometres, but it'd be a flash well over your head.
Hey, Ian, because we always associate lighthouses being big, tall towers with a light at the top, but if they were built on the top of a cliff, was it still necessary for them to be tall?
No, lots of examples of quite short towers. In New South Wales, people would be aware of Sugarloaf Point. That's a very short tower, not a great height required. And there are quite a few of those where they were put on high headlands and don't need to be very tall towers.
I've got a text here asking, in your opinion, what are some of the examples of the beautiful lighthouses that can be seen across the country?
Examples of beautiful lights? Oh, goodness, there's quite a few. There's if you're in Victoria, definitely take a visit to Cape Shank. It has a great... Janice Haynes runs wonderful tours at Cape Shank. That's worth visiting if you're in New South Wales. COVID, of course, has put some of these plans in disarray. New South Wales, we've got a few that open regularly in normal times, and Nora Head. Cape Byron, there's a very cohesive group of excellent volunteers who run wonderful tours at Cape Byron. Queensland, not so many that you can get into, but one that you must go and see is Busted Head. And I mentioned Stuart Buchanan before. Stuart has managed to restore the cottages. You can stay out there, and you can, of course, take the Lark out, which was used to service lights at many locations, and you can go into Busted Head. Western Australia, you've got Cape Leeuwin, which is where the Great Oceans meet. Wonderful tours there, and also at Cape Naturalist up the road. So, yeah, there's quite a few of the big classic heritage lights that are open.
I should actually point, because I live near there, Anglesey Lighthouse has also got a cafe, and they've also got a – you can go and visit the lighthouse and do tours there as well.
Yes, that's another
one. That's at Aries, yeah.
Yes.
What was the basic job of the lighthouse keeper, and did that change a lot as the years went by?
Oh, well, if it didn't move, you painted it, and if it moved, you oiled it.
Yeah.
So the keepers were pretty much responsible for most of, if not all, of the light station maintenance. They were supported on the technical items, so when diesel generation and things like that came in, that required more maintenance visits from people who were specialists in that area. But, yeah, the keepers did a wonderful job of maintaining those heritage buildings and the light structure.
And there would be the day-to-day, like there's a whole family thing, the day-to-day running of all sorts of things. And now, I guess, the people that are looking after, or as we heard, you can actually become part of community groups that help with lighthouses too.
Yes, there's quite a lot of friends groups that are doing extremely good work around the stations. If the station's operating, of course, those lights are maintained either by the state or AMSA, Australian Maritime Safety Authority, who that work is undertaken by a company called Australian Maritime Systems. They have a crew that goes around and maintains the lights. But the friends groups are very active and, in many cases, do a lot of the restoring of the cottages. And we've seen brilliant examples of that in recent times on South Solitary Island.
Thank you very much for telling us a little bit about it today. Our guest, Ian Clifford, President of Lighthouses of Australia.